I'm Ryan from the Dad.io podcast, a show dedicated to dorky dads everywhere. Part of the Gonna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other dadalicious geeky shows at GonnaGeekNetwork.com.
And welcome to Play Comics, where once again, we're just forgetting about the whole video game thing. And really, we're kind of forgetting about the whole comic thing on this one, too, because I am here with Eric and Julia Leewald, who worked on the original X-Men, the animated series back in the day. If you're old like me, you grew up watching it. So I think the first obvious question I have for y'all is, what is it like knowing that you're the reason why so many people like X-Men?
Well, it's gratifying. I mean, we really didn't know the books before we started back in '92. We were kind of new to them. So, I mean, I've read some comics when I was younger, but we weren't hired because of our depth of X-Men knowledge. So we discovered this cool world, and we at the time we were just really grateful for such a what ended up being such a fun job. Mm-hmm. It was really hard, but yep. it was about the most fun gig we've ever had out here, and the fact that it then was successful was a huge plus, and then that it's remained successful, because we talk to people your age and you know, just the fact you're sharing it with their kids now and that it's lasted, I mean, that's just, you couldn't ask for more than that if you're a creative person. It's huge to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if they didn't ask you guys to come on and work on it because you were giant X-Men fans, why did they ask y'all to come work on it?
Well, and to clarify the positions here, I served as a writer on X-Men animated series. I got to write Days of Future Past Part 1 in Season 1, came up and pitched story ideas for other episodes, wrote whatever it takes as a writer, and I got to be a fly on the wall. Eric was what we call the showrunner. Every script, every idea ran through your computer and your brain, and his name's on every episode. So yeah, Eric, why did they tap?
Well, it's the usual thing, just like in any business, the people that were doing the hiring and trying to decide which of maybe a couple dozen, you know, a few dozen people that might have been qualified, you know, that had done enough years of animation to entrust this with. So they were looking for animation writers that they felt close to. The Margaret Lesh, who was the president of Fox Kids, and
the brand new baby network at the time.
Her right-hand man, Sidney Eiwanger, and it happened that out of dumb luck, in my case, I'd been working about 7 years in our business, and about two of those 7 years, I'd worked for Sidney on other projects.
At what company that was?
One was there's a Japanese company called TMS. I worked for a year for him, just developing new shows. And we were, one of them was called Galaxy High, got sold, but you know, that's, you know, the roll of the dice, you develop 51 cells. But the year before X-Men was announced, I did a season of Beetlejuice with those two, with Margaret and Sidney, and they really seemed to like just the tone of my writing, I think. So it was just a right tool for the job kind of deal. There are a lot of writers out here that knew the books, and all of the artists on the show knew them backwards and forwards, were absolute comic geeks. So I got the gig because I'm sure they powwowed and said, you know, we've worked with a certain number of people over the years. Who do you think fits best for the kind of story, that's kind of sort of serious adult stories we're looking for? And I happen to be, you know, nearby and had just worked for them on Beetlejuice. So it was a personal connection. It was having worked for a couple of years with the people making the decisions.
On different projects.
It came down to that. They thought I fit, and I was glad to hear it.
So how did y'all decide which stories you wanted to have in the series?
Looking back now, how many years later, and we're still talking about it, but it's hard to believe it. But you were hired for 13 episodes. Yeah. I was hired for an episode, and all of us at the end of the first 13 episodes, we were let go because there was no confidence the show was going to be a hit of any kind. So when you sat down with Mark
The 13, I mean, you're right. There was 25 years of books to pick from, and we were kind of lucky. Marvel was just a small comic book company at the time, and in New York, they weren't this behemoth. And this great guy that became our advisor, who was in charge of their X-Men titles, and then Bob Harris, and he pulled me aside and said, "Look, I know you're going to get all sorts of, maybe may get some weird questions from the fans or worry about canon or whatever, but there are half a dozen different histories of the X-Men by now over 25 years. You could go in all sorts of, you know, half a dozen different directions. Just, you know, pick what you think are the best stories for these characters." And they helped decide who the characters were. Marvel did and Fox did, because they all had an input saying, you know, Marvel like wanted to push Gambit, and who's brand new, and Jubilee, who's new, and we built the team with input from all sorts of people. But as far as the stories went, we were pretty much left up to our own devices. And so since we weren't fanboys yet, we didn't have an agenda like, oh, I got to tell, you know, issue 107. I just got to. Or we weren't dying to see a certain character, another character. We're trying to make sense of this world and the weird situation back in 92 where 85% of our audience wouldn't know what the X-Men, who the X-Men were, or what a mutant was.
You have to really remember that back then, 30 years ago,
no movies. They were almost never in a TV show.
There was no internet. There was no Google.
Here's this fantastic world that we had to set up and make sense to people in like that opening two-part story. So that was basically what that story was all about. And then we wanted to, for the next 11, introduce each of the main characters a little more in depth so that you got to know them better, because that's what hooks people on TV shows. It's the people in them. It's not the spectacle. It's not an idea. It's, you know, who are the six friends? Who are the characters in Winnie the Pooh? Who are, you know, whatever it is, what stays with people forever? You know, who are the leads in Star Trek? Those things are what you hook onto. So we spent time, just the head writer and I,
Mark Edens,
just say, what kind of story can we tell with bits and pieces from old comic books? Because we wanted to use as much stuff from them as we could. What stories could we tell that would best show, okay, this is what Rogue is like? So we picked a story about her getting the chance to maybe lose her, get rid of her mutant power so she could touch people, because that was, and then, you know, what do we do with Storm? Okay, show her claustrophobia in an episode in the first season. What do we do with Wolverine? Okay, let him leave the X-Men because he's worried about his raises.
And Beast, being a character that was considered possibly minor back then,
yeah,
put him in the civil disobedience situation where he's gone.
Yeah. So it was a very practical, the first season was very practical, kind of, how do we introduce these nine lead characters, a little of their history, meet three or four of the main villains, and establish what the situation is between mutants and humans in this world. And besides that, we didn't really have any agenda. And that was absolutely positively the hardest part of doing this job, was deciding which 76 episodes to write. It was 59 distinct stories over 4.5 years that we worked on it. And there are thousands of stories we could have told. You know, why do you pick those? And some of them were misses. You know, we wish we could go back and change a couple of them.
I'll say it's a testament to the series, though, that people today still say it was so loyal and such a careful adaptation of the books. It it was an adaptation of the spirit of the books, but there weren't that many direct adaptations. I mean, I worked on Days of Future Past, but over the course of the show, a lot of original stories that felt like
they were part of the books, because we'd use characters from the books, or we'd use a scene or a reference point from one of the books. Mm-hmm. We got. It was hard because there was no internet. I couldn't just go on and check out all the stories that had been done. I couldn't look at Wikipedia and look at all the stuff that listed. There were reference books like Marvel Universe that would talk about people's relationships and their powers and their what they've done and what they haven't done with other characters. And so we used that and marked those up real heavily and said, okay, well, I'd love to find out more about Charles Xavier and his half brother, and you know why Juggernaut is a Juggernaut, and what that means to Xavier, as opposed to just, well, let's see if the Juggernaut can beat up the Hulk. You know, that stuff's going to be there. That's fun stuff, kind of the wrestling stuff. But the stuff that interested us was the personal family stuff among the characters we put together and outside, you know, from their personal lives.
And it sounds like from that aspect, they definitely grabbed, you know, some of the right people to work on it, because from all of my friends that like X-Men, that's the part that they like too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's kind of like, you know, the spectacle is fun and you got to do it because it's part of what everybody expects from that kind of show. But the real challenge, I mean, the thing that's satisfying to us looking back now all these years are the personal moments among the characters. So that's, you know, we made the right choice, I think, and it really helped. It helps in the writing too. It's if you're writing the same kind of fights over and over again, it gets old. If you're putting a character you know and care about in a new emotional situation, it makes the writing more fun and more intense.
So what were the big differences writing and making the show for season two onwards, knowing how much people enjoyed the show?
Oh, your season two order was, again, only for another 13.
Yeah.
So that was, there was no, but television tended to be orders of 13 episodes. So the first season, that was satisfying.
And the second one, To answer your question, yes. After it was suddenly this immense hit, which, as I say, they really didn't plan on, and as I said, they had to hire us all back, and some people weren't available. We lost a couple writers.
Yep.
We lost an artist or two because everybody'd gone off to other jobs while we were waiting for the animation to be finished. But so we were back in the second season, and we felt relieved. And because there, when you're waiting to see if something's going to work or not, you think you're writing the right kind of stories, but you're not sure. I mean, you don't know until the fans either take to a show or just don't at all. And you can think you've done some of your best work, and if it just doesn't play, you know, you just have to go on and do your next job. Until it was successful, we're waiting, you know, like 3 or 4 months to get animation back from overseas, because every cell had to be hand painted. It took forever. While waiting, a number of folks in the television community had really been questioning, you know, why are you making this so adult? This is for Saturday morning. You know, no kid's going to watch this. You know, over their cereal, they're all going to turn off and turn over to Scooby-Doo. They're not going to. This is really weird and different, and you're just going to fall on your face. And some of those people, you know, maybe were like advertisers that had money at stake, local stations that if our show bombed, well, you know, they're going to lose out to all their competitors because we stuck them with this odd mutant show that no kid liked. So we got a lot of that pressure. Luckily, all the creative people and the network creative executives really believed that kids would go for a serious show like that. So we stuck to it, and we resisted dumbing it down, or resisted making it too childish. And when it finally came out and it worked, then all those weird phone calls and pushback about it being too weird a show to succeed, it was all gone. Mm-hmm. It was all, okay, now it's part of a hit and everybody loved it from the beginning. And just write whatever you want, guys. So we felt a certain freedom, both that we weren't getting criticized anymore for doing such a strangely adult show, and that, okay, we'd set it up the basic world in the first 13. Now we can go off on deeper stories, maybe with an individual, like with Beast, when he with the blind girl, or in the third season with Meet Nightcrawler. And you know, those are things, if you're trying to establish this story with these nine lead characters, if you go off and do like the Nightcrawler story too early, people are wondering, well, what's the show about? I mean, I thought it was about those nine people that live in the X-Mansion. You got two of them hanging out with a weird guy in, you know, in a ski lodge. What's the show? So we were able to take, the longer the show was on, the more chances and more strange things we were able to do with the characters mm-hmm. that weren't so setup focused.
Now, what are some characters that you wish you could have gotten in the show that you didn't get a chance to?
The challenge with, as a writer on the show, when you have a team, there are a lot of people to service just in the, you know, up front, and trying to make sure everyone gets their moment of glory and or everyone gets accounted for, you know, as you're writing for one or two of the others. Now, looking back, Nightcrawler is such a fascinating character. It would have been tremendous to have been able to explore him more. But every character you would like to bring in and pay more attention to means you're paying less attention to the main team. And that's a challenge. That's a challenge.
Yeah, that we again, it's the kind of thing that we had writers that were super fans of the books, and they knew 200 or 300 characters, and they had favorite people that they really were anxious to bring in. And they would pitch stories like, you know, if X Factor was gonna get a guest star or whatever, if somebody was X Factor crazed, they would pitch stories involving those characters, and they had that agenda. But we really didn't. We just looked at every episode about, you know, how can we best service our lead people. And Marvel might tell us about somebody, like they'll say, you know, Magneto's really important, or, you know, you got to get to know Sinister, or, you know, there are certain superstars in the Marvel universe that they wanted us to make sure to include at some point. But we really didn't have, some writers did and some artists had agenda about people they wanted, but as she was saying, it's so hard just to service the 8 or 9 folks that are there. My instinct was, I don't want to talk about a guest star unless I can see how he or she reveals something about one of our leads, like Nightcrawler. He ended up being wonderful, mm-hmm. but he was introduced through Wolverine, and you know, half that show is Wolverine going through a crisis of faith while you get to know Nightcrawler. So when we introduce new people, we try to think of them in terms of the relations to the current cast, and never try to do a show about just about the guest people.
We kind of have the perfect timing here, because as we're getting the setup, I got probably 15 to 20 messages sent to me, hey, look, X-Men 97. And of course, it was a big day at work, so I have no idea what they're talking about. So, how excited were y'all knowing that there's going to be a continuation of the series happening?
Yeah, well, it's a big deal.
It's huge. And the fact that we've been asked to participate, listen, Hollywood can be a big, ugly place. Not everyone gets to revisit things that they may have worked on. The fact that, and for the last, 5-6 years, there hasn't been kind of an orchestra, there has not been an organized push for X-Men, we've been kind of yelling in the void, like, hey, remember the show? We really liked it. It was a lot of fun. Remember, remember? Yeah. And just the discovery of the giant fan base was kind of a thing that we hadn't really been plugged into. Then to have the X-Men 97 opportunity present itself, the catch, I guess, was not really knowing when an announcement might be made, and then the discovery that it was going to be November 12th on Disney Plus Day, and that's when
it all went crazy.
The fire hoses opened up, and we've just been trying to not knock ourselves over with the giant rush of excitement.
Yeah, and it was gratifying that they took the time. We've dealt with this a huge crew. I mean, I wish we had half the budget when we did our show that they've got now. Mm-hmm. Huge crew, and we met them. We realized they were all crazed fans. The average age looked about 30, so they were kids. They were very small when the show came out. Grew up with the show and are sincere fans about it. And the fact that it is a continuation of what we're doing, as opposed to a reimagining or different characters or a different tone
or a different time frame.
Yeah, the fact they decided, okay, we're going to continue. That was a question we got asked. The last 5 years, we've been going to cons a lot, a couple times a month, since we've had a couple books out. And every single con, someone raises a hand and says, is it going to be another season? And we always say, well, you know, it's not up to us. They're not our characters. They're not our money. You know, if Marvel, I'm sure Marvel plan to do this. There are so many fans worldwide. They'd be foolish not to. But we haven't heard anything. And we really hadn't.
And we haven't.
And we weren't lying. There wasn't an NDA. We just, for years, Marvel was probably planning this and thinking about it in private and scheming to get it started.
And once Disney acquired Marvel, I'm sure that kind of got, because it was a rights issue.
Yeah.
It had fallen through the cracks because of rights issues.
Yeah, it was kind of split rights, and then it came together, and now it was possible to do. It's only been possible to do for about 2.5 years now. And before that, 3 or 4 different people, like Fox, had parts of the rights to the show, so it wouldn't have been possible to do. Now it's possible, and we saw something that just blew us away, Julie found online. About Disney Plus, where when it came out 2 years ago, they asked the fans. They did a poll. They said, of all the stuff we've got, all the Pixar stuff, all the Star Wars stuff, all the Walt Disney television and movie stuff, all the Marvel movies, all the Marvel TV shows, which is the one that you're most excited about
to see
when you sign up for Disney Plus? And by some margin, the number one response out of over 100 shows was our show.
X-Men the Animated Series.
Which just melted us, just thinking that...
We beat The Mandalorian?
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's the... And who knows? I mean, there's been new stuff since then, but at the time, the fan base was saying that. We know it's been 25 years, but this is what this is what we want to see. You put on your so
it hasn't always been available either. There was never a boxed DVD set released in the U.S. individual seasons, but it hasn't been on the air for the last 25 years
constantly. But yeah. A lot of this other stuff hasn't either. So
true.
So it's just a case of when they asked the fans, that was a choice. So yep. If you were a Disney executive, it seems like it'd be a no-brainer. This is perhaps the biggest hit you guys have ever had in your portfolio. Why don't you do more episodes? And so finally that stuck with somebody, and they got the engine, the massive Marvel Disney machine going, and now it's happening. And we're jazzed that they, you know, with this whole huge new team, and I believe it's their series. It's the new people's series. But the fact they wanted us on as consultants, that's a big deal to us.
Yes.
We appreciate it. We know lots of people that in other shows where they're doing remakes or doing continuations or new versions of, and never get a phone call about it. And the fact they actually hired us to be consultants was...
With Larry Houston.
Along with producer director Larry Houston, who was in charge of the art side of things. was really gratifying.
Yes.
So obviously there's going to be things you can't tell me, either because it hasn't been decided yet or because the giant mouse lawyers will end my life. But not yours, because they seem to like you, but then they don't have that connection to me. But
yeah,
is there any inside secret-y stuff that you can tell us?
Well, inside secret-y in the general vague sense, that the fact that they are calling it X-Men 97 was one of those, okay, that tells me as a fan of the show kind of where their heads may be in this.
Yeah, and that they should be making references to our show and that
universe.
And what has happened to those characters during our 5 years of stories, and assuming that that's the background of it, versus, you know, very different characters, younger characters with you know, different backgrounds. They're treating our show as canon and personal history for these characters is a big deal. The cast, which was just it's another cool thing they did. 9 voices from our show, Wolverine, Rogue, Beast. Those three are reprising their roles, so the voice is going to be there. And other people, like the voice of Storm and the voice of Jubilee and four or five others, voice of Gambit, they're going to be doing other characters, guest characters. Yeah. So that shows how much they respected our show and wanted this for the fan base to be kind of family, kind of something that didn't have a break in it, that even if it was, you know, 30 years newer technology going into making this thing look beautiful and much bigger budgets, that it's going to feel like the same characters, the same people to the fans watching. And I think they've done everything they can to make that happen.
So you've had all this time to think about stories that you want to do. Like, how much of the comics have you gone and read since your show ended?
don't wrap us on our knuckles here, but we were sort of thinking about that when Eric was handed the torch to do X-Men the Animated Series, there had been 30 years of comic book X-Men up until that point. And now we're having a conversation with you, and there have been another 30 years of X-Men comic books since the animated series. And it's a wild and woolly world out there in terms of the different teams, the different iterations,
And to be completely honest, no, we haven't kept up. So we know there's certain changes, like, you know, Beast has become more intense and
intense
edgy.
Is a word, yeah.
in some of the books, and you know, there have been different strains of them, but we just we know one of the things that it's one of the things that we did respond to after we stopped making the show was, we saw after we'd come up with the story called One Man's Worth,
the two-parter in season 4 of the series.
Yeah, when that, I think it was like February or March of 94, that but in any case, it was one of the handful of most wonderful shows, we think, that stories we think we came up with that having to do with what would happen to the X-Men if Charles Xavier had never lived, or what would happen to the world if this one man hadn't lived. And then found out that Marvel and Bob Harris and the books had taken that basic idea and
which was your original idea, your pitch,
and run with it and created probably the best set of books since we did our show, the Age of Apocalypse series. That was really gratifying, because we'd taken so many good bits from, say, Chris Claremont's writing, from books mostly from the 70s and early 80s, and then to see that they would go and take a basic setup that we'd given them from One Man's Worth and turned it and build it into something as large and satisfying as Age of Apocalypse, that was really, that was, again, that's just from our point of view, we felt like we were really collaborating with the people that had built this world. And, you know, we used so much from them, now they were able to use some from us.
I mean, I'm one of the weird people that doesn't read the main book. I read a bunch of the side books. So the characters that I've mostly gotten to fall in love with, I'm not expecting to see in this series. So if it happens, then, you know, yay, that's good for me.
I'm trying to think if there's anybody from our series that's not going to be involved. The best we can tell, they're bringing back the whole cast. I mean, you know, when we left off the show, Xavier had just been banished to the Shi'ar Empire and
taken away because he was mortally wounded. He wasn't banished. He was wounded.
He was taken away for his health.
Mm-hmm.
But the impression we get is that they're going to use everybody that we used and more. And that's really, you know, it's really in their court how they play that out and how the relationships grow. And, you know, I mean, I think they're reverent enough that things aren't going to get weird. I mean, Scott and Jean are still going to be Scott and Jean. They're not going to suddenly not know each other.
I see what you're saying.
I think the relationships at least are going to start out pretty much exactly the way we left them. If they then evolve and people change and new connections are made, you know, at the end of the season or in season two, you know, that's very cool on them. But we really get the impression it's going to start off very familiar to our fan base, that it's going to be what they left off with.
Well, I hope things do get weird because it is X-Men. And that's kind of what happens.
Very true. Very true.
So one of the things that most of the people that I'm friends with who are into X-Men, and, you know, by extension me, because they're the ones who really got me into X-Men, you know, of the people that aren't the show, really like about X-Men is just all of the social commentary stuff, like, that you can slip into the characters. And I have to imagine that back on a 90s kids show, there was only so much you could get away with.
We've talked about this, and to all credit to Margaret Lesh, president of Fox Kids, and Sydney Iwaner, her right-hand man, who
pushed us, who said that nobody's done any of this stuff in kids animation before, but do it. They said, you know, do all you can.
Treat it like an hour length live action drama for adults that happens to be a half hour Saturday morning cartoon.
You know, we couldn't have an episode about the AIDS epidemic, which was happening in 1992.
Or about police brutality and
we could have mutants that weren't being accepted by the people around them, and you could, you know, the allegory was there, the reference was there.
The Friends of Humanity people were there.
We got some great support to do it, but obviously, being a Saturday morning show, there's just certain things we didn't touch on.
So much of it was, as you were saying, the ability to use the allegory of mutant and otherness, in spite of having spectacular superhero powers. That I think was the core of the show. The fact that you and Mark Edens chose to open the series not with a mutant on mutant fight, but instead with the presentation of the Sentinels as these robotic things that scared humans had crafted to go out there and, you know, handle the mutant menace for us.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you've got the world where we have Professor Xavier saying, we got to work with the humans, we need to try and work this out together. And then by the time you introduce Magneto, you're like, Magneto may have a point here. A lot of the humans could just be jerks, and I don't want a part of it. So that provided a the kind of dynamic that I don't think you would have had if you started off with, you know, big mutants fighting each other.
And the great thing was is that we were handed the social issue kind of on a platter with the fact that these people are struggling with their mutancy.
Yep.
And we pushed that and we focused on that where other people might not have. But, you know, if we're handed the Avengers, or is that just a bunch of super powerful people stopping other super powerful people from doing stuff? It's not the same focus. So the social issues don't naturally arise if you're doing, say, the Avengers or the Fantastic Four versus doing the X-Men. And the X-Men come with this built-in, you know, anxiety and sense of otherness that made for a lot of the good, deep stuff that came out in the storytelling. Mm-hmm. When they're crafting the stories, we're trying to focus on the characters and the character moments, but the other stuff, the issues were always underneath. And that just, I think it really helped. It helped people feel empathy for our lead characters where they normally might not have cared as much than otherwise.
Do you have any reason to think that kind of thing is going to just suddenly not be in the continuation?
Oh, no. I think it's going to be even more.
I don't know how you couldn't have that in there. That's baked into what the X-Men are.
And 2021 is so full of those issues.
Oh,
you know,
my God.
We made certain gags in some of the time travel episodes, like, you know, it's in the future, and Storm thinks, you know, racism, skin color racism is quaint because, you know, probably hasn't been around for a couple decades in their world. And so the fact that, given what we've all been going through the last few years, and you know they're going to hit the social issues as hard or harder than we did when they do their show.
And again, because that's who the X-Men are.
Yeah.
That's what their worlds are. Yeah.
So, yeah. No, believe me, these are not a group of people that are just going to forget about that and show some fun action. It's going to be, and it's going to be slightly more adult. It's Disney Plus, so they don't have restrictions. I mean, Wolverine never stabbed anybody with his claws. He ripped a bunch of Sentinels apart, but he never, you know, there were limits to how adult we could make the show, given the rules of children's television. And they won't have all those limits on Disney Plus. They may be some self-imposed ones, but they're going to be able to be more adult and more open with social questions and personal questions and questions of identity and questions of
everything.
Of everything, you know, adult issues that we could push some of and do you know, allegories for, but they're going to be able to be more straightforward than we were with those sort of things.
I'm so excited for that. Like, of anything else, like I've been talking to some younger people who have gone back and looked at the show, and I mean, they're definitely young enough to where the show was done being able to be found in legal ways before they were born.
And they'd be young and know how to do that.
But I mean, they look at it and they're looking at things through their 2021 eyes and forgetting that you have to take into account your 1992 context of everything.
Yeah, I think Wolverine is going to be able to curse more.
That would be refreshing.
Yeah.
Oh, I know, right?
He's not.
Although, salute to the great line, "You egg-sucking piece of gutter trash."
Which is from The Wild Bunch, which got all sorts of crap for being such a violent movie.
An iconic Western.
In 1969. Yeah. But yeah, it's like in old publishing, in old novels, in TV shows and movies before a certain time, there were just words you couldn't say and things you couldn't show.
Mm-hmm.
And good creative people found ways around that, ways to imply things without showing them. And as I said, I bet Wolverine's going to be able to smoke a cigar, which was absolutely forbidden. I mean, it's one thing for him to want to rip someone's throat out and sound like it. It's another thing for him to actually smoke. That would have been, you know, or ride a motorcycle without a helmet on.
In spite of his regenerative powers.
Yeah, there's just certain things that we could not show in a child's television show that they're going to have total freedom to show in their show.
So I really hope you can answer this, but please tell me they're at least keeping something very similar to the theme song.
We don't know for sure. If I were them, that would be job one.
I did see on Twitter, Ron Wasserman, who is the fellow who
wrote
deserves
it.
All the credit in the world for that, plus the Mighty Morphin Power Ranger theme song. This man made the soundtrack for most of our lives, most of your generation's lives. I understand he has a meeting set in January.
Oh.
So we'll see.
I did that one. I didn't know about
that.
Yeah. But you'd think that would be the last thing they could do without, because it's such a hook for so many people.
Yeah.
They don't want to, you don't want to be repetitive, but you at least want to make a reference to it. They'd be crazy not to.
But that's all we know right now.
And they haven't told us. And, the show's not going to come out for another 18, 20 months, mid to late 2023.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to have a lot of back and forth to see what works and what doesn't for them. But I bet the house that their theme song is going to have elements of our theme song in it.
I mean, that's just 18 to 20 months of people being able to make up theories, which is either the best or the worst thing in the world, depending on how you're looking at it.
Yeah.
They haven't shared that with us yet.
So what is the most exciting part for y'all about having this show come back?
I'm just going to say it flat out. The fact that it's coming back. You could have called us at any time since the show ended in 1997 and asked us, wow, that was a fun run. What do you think the odds are of this show coming back? And at any point along the way, none, zero. It wasn't going to happen. There were other iterations. The next came X-Men Evolution, and then after that came Wolverine and the X-Men. Then there was the anime style X-Men. But again, over the years, the rights issues, all this stuff, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
And it's weird. They did different things with the movies. It's satisfying to us because it kind of feels like we were involved. Just to give something more from our generation, that we were involved in the original Star Trek TV show. And then if you see they do The Next Generation and they do movies and they do Discovery and all these children of the original, it's got to be satisfying. I mean, for us, it's obviously satisfying that what we did struck enough of a chord that then they decided they wanted to do other series. They decided mm-hmm. they wanted to do movies.
Yes.
Out of the success of our show. And that just, it's wonderful, because you really don't know when you're doing something if something's going to grab people and be part of their lives. And
right.
This magic came together on this, the right people, the right basic idea, the X-Men idea, the right time in the 90s when we were able to do this. It's been a couple of years earlier, they wouldn't have let us do such an ambitious show. If it had been different executives, it could have been, X-Men Babies.
Right.
You don't have control.
You don't.
Most of the time out here, there's a lot of money involved, and it's not your money. So if you want to write for yourself, write some poetry.
Which is fine.
And self-publish it. But working in a professional business like that, when there are millions of dollars at stake, you have to listen to the people you're working with. And it's a huge group of people. It's hundreds of people
mm-hmm.
who worked on the show.
Yep.
And if even a couple small groups, if Ron's music had sucked, if a couple of the cast members hadn't been as good as they were, if the artists hadn't cared as much about keeping the designs right, any one of those elements, if it hadn't been there, the show might not have stuck for people. It might have just kind of, okay, you did a show, you got paid, go on, do your next show.
Mm-hmm.
But it all came together and fit, and boy, that doesn't happen. We'll tell you, we did this for 30 years. It doesn't happen very often.
So that being said, is there another Marvel or otherwise comic property you would want to make a animated series for?
Well, that's an interesting question. Just because, again, we're wrapping our heads around X-Men 97 right now. And the fact that Marvel is... You know what? I would like to do a What If. And I can't say anything more than that, but that would be my fantasy, to do an episode for their What If. Because I got an idea that I want to do for What If. That's what I would want to do.
Yeah. And
if they're listening.
And there have been other things that they've done that have been nice surprises.
Like
Guardians was a nice surprise out of the blue, you know, when the movie came out. Like, you know, this is such a different tone from the other X-Men movies. Or the one with Ryan Reynolds.
Deadpool
came out. Yeah.
Versus Iron Man.
I can still remember. These things last for so long. When we went to Marvel after we finished two seasons, and so it was the summer of 1993.
Oh, you flew to New York for a meeting, because they were based out of New York.
Yeah, when they committed to seasons 3 through 5,
I mean, all at once.
We went, and one of the guys there at Marvel handed me a comic, said, "You may not know that this one yet. It just came out. It's called Deadpool." And so I just was going through my files. I picked up, "Hey, this is the first issue of Deadpool that I've never opened." So maybe I can make a sale on that one. But Marvel has this huge universe. Mark, the Edens brothers, and I, who did so much of the writing on the show, we actually, back in the late 90s, after we were done, we pitched a Thor series.
That's right.
To, was it UPN Network? And it didn't fly. And again, I think it was because it was a really kind of tough-ass Thor series. It's like Game of Thrones and Sopranos Thor, and heavy on the mythology and light on the lame doctor and the funny stuff happening with humans business. So it just, whoever was buying at UPN then kind of just shook their heads and said, we don't think we can sell that. And again, you're selling something for a kid's time slot at the time, and so it just may have been way too dark for them. But that would we wrote up the show bible and had story ideas. We had that really well developed, and they didn't go for it. But that was one I think I would have enjoyed doing. Again, think of Thor and Loki and those folks, and think with a kind of Game of Thrones tone to the animation, and that would have been something I would have loved to do.
So what's stopping you from pulling out of the box now and trying to get somebody to make it?
Good question.
We may just do that. And it's one of these things that we've just started meeting people in the new Marvel. And that's part of one of the challenges in Hollywood. All the people that we used to write shows for are retired now. And it's new people that come in that don't know us, haven't worked with us. So there are new people. I mean, Kevin Feige was like a production assistant on the first X-Men movie in 2000, 21 years ago. So he knows that we did the TV show because he probably saw it as a teenager or whatever, but he's never worked with us. So there are people that we think we will now be meeting, or at least meeting connections of theirs, that we'd be able to make that kind of pitch. Otherwise, they probably have planned out the next 5 years of movies and TV shows.
Of course.
On the short end of things. And,
I know. So if we pitched it, it would probably be, coming in 2030, but that would be cool. I mean, that would be, and believe me, when we get the chance, we will bring it up, because I know it would be fun to write.
Well, I'm excited to see more from y'all and just what can happen with this. I also somehow have not run across your book out in the wild.
Well, it's been a year and a half of pandemic.
Oh, there were two of them.
Yes.
There's this big, massive coffee table book that's full of original art, art from the show, and just it's very focused on the designing and making of the series. The first book, the one that came out in October 2017, Previous on X-Men, it's, since we didn't have rights to any of the artwork, it's a dense, what, 500 page
oral history.
Oral history. We interviewed 36 people, most of the cast, executives, writers, artists, all talking about how much they loved being part of the show and what were their favorite things to write or draw or to record, or, you know, what were their, you know.
And how many times the show almost got derailed before it got on the air.
The first 7 or 8 months, there's a lot of drama in there about, oh my God, we all just got called and I think we're all going to get fired kind of moments.
Yeah, or I'm going to have to, I'm going to put my foot down here and say, if you choose to go this direction, you will need to fire me.
Yeah.
From the creative side, and that happened multiple times.
Yeah. So the first book is for fans. Really, it's everything behind the scenes. It's, I think it's like 10 pages about a big intense meeting with Stan Lee and the president of Fox Television. I mean, there's an 11 page interview with Kel Dodd. And there's one that long with Len Wein, who created half these characters.
Yeah, whom we lost.
Yeah, just passed recently.
Yeah.
You know, the person that created Wolverine and Storm and Nightcrawler and Colossus. And
then wrote for the series. He got to write on the show,
and
which was wonderful.
And did 4 episodes for us, which was really, there's something humbling. You know, you're doing an adaptation of the X-Men. You look up and wait a minute, this is the guy that created most of the characters we're using. And he's going to write for me, and I got to give him notes. And in the interview, there's a hilarious moment where the executive above me, where Sydney was going over a script with Len, and he just said, "You know what, Len? I think Wolverine wouldn't say that." And then Len just kind of sat there and smiled and said, "Yeah, he would, Sid." And Sydney realized, "Oh shit. Man, this is the guy that created the character, so I guess he'd know what Wolverine would say." Situation like that.
One time, Sydney backed down.
Yeah, the only time we ever saw him back down. But there's
a
lot of that fun stuff in the first book, and the second book is just, you know, beautiful cells from, you know, animation cells from back then. You know, 99% of which are now gone, because people just don't, you know, in those days, they just would throw that stuff away. You get all these gorgeous bits of artwork that, you know, people spent years doing overseas
to build.
Here's our favorite.
Here's
a three-cell
layout
for the Shi'ar battleship.
Yeah, just gorgeous.
You know, all this gorgeous stuff, and people just used to throw it away by the ton.
See, we had to go on an archaeological dig like Raiders of the Lost Ark to find the art for this new book, X-Men, the Art and Making of the Animated Series.
Some artists saved the stuff.
Thank you, Larry Houston. Thank you, Dan Diesenmeyer. Thank you, Mark Lewis, who happens to have kept it. There was no centralized library for any of this because, again, the rights issues. Marvel was going bankrupt, Fox owned Storm's
and it costs money to store the stuff.
Yeah.
You have to make sure to try to store it, you know, with some sort of sense of temperature and humidity control, because the art on plastic cells is going to start to warp or to chip, and
it's not made to be durable. Made to be photocopied, shot, and then
erased. So the same thing used to happen with comic books, and used to happen with, you know, Len Wein says something about that. When he was a kid, he went in to try to work at Marvel and DC back in the 50s, and some of the executives there were just looking at the stuff. Could have been the 50s, early, could have been the 60s when he started as a teenager. Anyway, they just looked, they had stacks and stacks and stacks of original artwork from Golden Age, you know, 40s and 50s Marvel books. And the boss just said, just kids, throw that in the trash.
I believe the guy said, cut it in half and throw it away.
Yeah.
Because that way, you know, and so.
And Len and his buddies kind of looked at us, are you kidding? And they took it, you know, down to the alleyway and they split, you know, they split it up among themselves and, and wouldn't throw it away. But it took people like that saying no or recognizing that this stuff was amazing to hold on to it. So we said we were lucky to find enough beautiful art remaining from the show that we were able to make the book work.
And this book is made in conjunction with Marvel Disney. They reached out to us after Eric wrote the first book previously on X-Men. Once Disney and Marvel joined forces, and then asked us to work with them on this new book, which again, coffee table art book for the show.
Yeah.
So that's been very nice. That's been really gratifying.
And I'm sure you'd only been thinking about how you'd put something like that together like every day since the show ended.
You know, not really.
We're not artists. We don't have that skill set, and we sure didn't have the library of stuff.
And to be honest, the rhythm that we were used to was, okay, you finish your show and then you get on the next show. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've worked on like 45 shows. She's worked on about the same. Our friend Larry, who did the art for so much of the art for X-Men, he's worked on 80 some shows.
Yep.
And so it's like just, okay, I got a new gig. That old gig was fine, but now I'm working on the new one. Until we had a little spare time, about 15 years later, we started thinking back and realizing, geez, that's the best thing we ever did. You know, maybe we should write down some about it. Maybe we should talk to some other people that worked on the show and see if they have the same memory we did.
We were lucky we had space above our garage, and we were like tail end of paper. So we had every storyboard, we had every script and every iteration, we had all the notes in boxes above our garage. Versus today, everything on computer, you know, it's just a different thing. We had the ephemera to go back and recreate what the series, how it was to work on the series.
Yeah, so that was handy.
So this might be the best thing you've ever worked on, but my wife and I have a theory that any animated series worth watching has at least one person involved in it who has worked on Transformers.
Before or after?
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
After, yeah, we, on Transformers. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. We didn't work on the early one back in the 80s, but I worked on, when I broke into the business, the first job I got in January 1985 was working on Challenge of the GoBots, which was a competitor for Transformers. And it was my first gig for Hanna-Barbera, and I wrote six of them. So, but we did. About 3 years ago, we did a Transformers
Robots in Disguise,
right? Mm-hmm. And that was great fun. Some very good, very talented.
Oh my gosh!
People running that show, and a couple of them that we'd known for a while. But
that was
great fun.
My wife really liked that series. I haven't gotten around to watching it yet.
Oh well, that's nice to know.
Yeah.
But she did ask specifically, like, which episode and stuff you'd been credited with, and I told her. She remembers those.
I was going to say, I have to think now, but if you can look it up on IMDb, it should be there,
So it has been great talking to you about this. I have a couple other questions that I ask everybody at the end, just to kind of wrap things up. First off, who is your favorite Muppet?
As soon as I answer you, I'm going to go, Oh, well, I adore Beaker. Just the absolute stone cold panic in Beaker as everything's going on around him with Professor Honeydew. But I also, golly, you know, Fozzie Bear. He just is so happy and so, you know, just.
Well, when I was a kid, I was a math guy, so I like to count.
Oh, there you go. Well, that's more Sesame Street, but we'll count that. Yeah.
Does he doesn't count as a Muppet? Okay, yeah.
I let y'all count that however you need to. So if you want to count the count, then he counts. Because he counts.
Okay.
There you go.
Let's try to see how many times I can slip a count in there.
Uh-huh.
And finally, what do y'all want to do when you grow up?
I don't know. Write more cartoons.
That sounds good. I like that too. Well, listen, it didn't even occur to me when I was a kid growing up that someone could do what I do and get paid for it. Writing was a fantasy gig, but it was never like, oh, people actually create those things. People actually write scripts. People actually, because I grew up in Texas, and this is still every day I pinch myself going, I can't believe I'm here.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, when I was a little girl, like 6 or 7, I wanted to be a baker. But I know that, and I love to bake, that's my happy place. But bakers have to deal with horrific hours. They have to get up real early to get stuff going, and I'm grateful I'm not that. But I want to be what I grow up. I want to do this and keep doing it. Yeah.
This is just too good, and it was a good, you know, things don't necessarily last out here. In Hollywood, it's very strange. I'm from East Tennessee, and where a lot of my friends came out here because we loved movies, and we looked around and said, "This is a strange world. How in the world do we break into it?" I can't imagine. I thought when I was really young, because my dad was a professor and my mom was a teacher, that I'd do that, and now I'm glad that I was able to, I mean, and that would have been very satisfying, but I'm glad I've been able to write stories and under the kind of TV pressure that we were under, and fix the problems and hold the stuff together. Because half of it is just holding the stuff together.
Yes, it is.
And meeting your deadlines. That part of it is just, it's really satisfying, you know, keeping the show going and making it somehow all fit. That kind of puzzle making and problem solving has been really satisfying. Yeah, so I can't think of anything else.
Well, I hope you'll never have to grow up. That's my plan too.
Okay. All right.
Okay. But it has been great talking to y'all about all of this. Where else can people find you around the internet if they want to hear more from you?
Please, please, please. We have a website, xmentas.com, and that's for X-Men the Animated Series.com. I am on Twitter way too much. I think that's how we found each other, at xmentas. We have an Instagram page. We're presence xmentas, a lot of xmentas. So, and on Facebook. So please come try and find us, especially now with all the excitement of the fact that xmentas is lurching forward into the new world with an X-Men 97, which I still can't believe it's happening. This is crazy.
And if I just need to grab your books to hold me over until the new series starts up, do you have a recommended place where we can go pick those up?
If you go to any of our links, xmentas.com or Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, we have links in our profiles to purchase through Amazon. Now, we support every local bookstore, every independent bookseller, every comic book store. We just can't guarantee where the books are.
And if you go, the first book, which came out with a small publisher out here in California called Jacobs Brown, if you go and buy on the hardback on their website, it's probably about the same price as Amazon. It should be similar. It'll be a signed copy. They sat me down and had me sign a couple thousand of them for them. So if you get the book directly from the publisher for it, previously on X-Men through Jacobs Brown, you'll get a signed copy.
And also, with the holiday rush coming up, we're not kidding. Paper is not as easily obtainable as it used to be, and books are getting harder to come by. So if you
so
have
buy
a
fan, fast.
Buy them fast. If you have a fan in that you're shopping for this holiday season, please consider either one of the books, and buy it now.
Well, I'll be buying it for me. So if it gets here late, that's my own fault, and I'll just have to be mad at myself. As always, if you want to hear more from me, the best place to do that is to go over to playcomics.com, where you can have links to all the social media stuff. Check out comic reviews, check out other random articles that we're writing about other random things that aren't comic reviews. And you can go there and support the show, where, you know, for just $1 a month, you can get episodes as they become ready. And you can try to help me decide what happens if NFTs come to Patreon, because I don't like that shit. It's bad. Play Comics is a part of the Get a Geek Network, home to a bunch of other wonderfully geeky shows. They're so wonderful that I am dumbfounded and can't think of any other adjectives to use to describe them. If you like the music that I'm really talking on top of right now, head on over to soundcloud.com/best-day to check out Best Day's music. But most of all, just grab a game, grab a stack of comics, and go find yourself a new favorite character.